Thank you, Michael, for that introduction. I'm not sure I can promise the elixir of life, but it will be an interesting talk, hopefully. So I put this this sort of cartoon up initially just to orientate everybody to the subject matter of tonight's talk. And it's a DNA double helix, and I'm sure many of the people in this room, certainly my colleagues, would agree this is by far the most beautiful molecule in biology. I mean, it's just stunning in its symmetry and it's stunning in its function. It is, of course, the molecule by which genes are transmitted from one generation to the next, both at the cellular level and at the individual level, so it accounts for the similarities amongst us and for many of the differences amongst us. And an intrinsic feature of that molecule you would expect is a high degree of stability. This is a molecule that has to maintain our genes in an intact state for many, many years and ultimately be duplicated and passed on from generation to generation. Now, that's where the problem lies, and this is really the subject of my talk tonight, because like any biological molecule, DNA has an intrinsic instability associated with its structure. And that's because the chemical bonds that make up the molecule are prone to degrade at a certain frequency. In addition to that, DNA lives in an extremely hostile environment in the cell. And the DNA molecules are bombarded by electrophilic molecules in the nucleus continuously on a continuous basis. So it's under severe attack all of the time. So it's very important that cells have evolved ways to recognize DNA once it becomes damaged and to deal with that damage and help maintain DNA in a format that's compatible with life and with heredity. And that's really the subject of today's talk. So I'm very aware that this is an extremely general audience, and for many of you, your understanding or experience of biology and chemistry is limited at this stage. So I have minimized the amount of hardcore chemistry and hardcore biology that I'm including in the talk. There are certain pockets where you will encounter chemistry, and I'll talk you through those as best as I can. And this is one of those slides. So this essentially is half a DNA molecule. It's one strand of the DNA duplex. So normally this would be two duplexes wrapped around each other. And I'm just showing one strand here for simplicity. And the reason for showing this slide is to really emphasize to you the severity of the types of attack that DNA is continually receiving in its normal native environment in a cell. So DNA can be stripped down to two essential components. The first component is this sugar phosphate backbone, shown here in what looks like a gray color on the screen. And we have deoxyribose sugar alternating with phosphate moieties. And this forms the backbone of the molecule. This is essentially the spine of the DNA structure that you're familiar with, and it accounts for the DNA double helical entity. That's subject to attack all of the time, particularly by oxidative species that arise all of the time in cells. And those oxidative species will essentially attack the deoxyribose moiety at multiple sites, actually. And the deoxyribose moiety can disintegrate. And when that happens, because the deoxyribose forms the backbone of the molecule, the DNA essentially is cut in two. Now, if you have scission or cutting of one strand, you end up with a single strand break, and that's really the topic of my the focus of my work. But if you have cutting on both strands at an adjacent site, you can have a complete chromosome scission, and the two parts of the chromosome can come apart. So that's the deoxyribose backbone. But of course, the coding entity, the entity that gives DNA its coding potential and makes us what we are, comes from a different part of the molecule, and that is encoded by these nuclear bases: guanine, cytosine, thymine, and adenine. And of course, this is all that differentiates us as individuals. But of course, what's important is the order of these bases in terms of their linear sequence. Now, these bases are also susceptible to attack by genotoxins in cells. And they're susceptible to attack at multiple sites, as shown here. And these bases can be oxidized, they can be alkylated, and they can even be attacked by simple water molecules, of which most of our bodies are made up. And those water molecules will facilitate hydrolysis of some of these bonds. For example, this glycosyl linkage here, coupling the base to the sugar, can be attacked by water, resulting in a loss of coding intensity. So the upshot of all those types of damage is that in a cell, DNA is damaged hundreds of thousands of times per day. So every cell in your body during this one-hour lecture will be damaged at least 10 or 20,000 times. And that's a phenomenal amount of insult for what is supposed to be a stable hereditary molecule to receive. And there must be mechanisms in a cell to deal with that damage. Okay, so DNA then requires maintenance and repair, and that's really the underlying message of tonight. What are the consequences of unrepaired damage? So if a cell loses the ability to repair particular types of damage, it can have severe consequences. At a cellular level, there are two major types of cell fate that can occur. The first one is cell death. That's clearly not a very nice scenario for a cell. Excessive unrepaired damage can result in cell death. There is another cell fate which can potentially be even worse, cell survival, which sounds strange, right? Why is cell survival a nasty fate? Well, this cell is sort of misguided to some extent, and if you explain to him the fact that he's living with large amounts of unrepaired damage and that what he might actually be carrying are potentially are genetic mutations, he becomes slightly worried. Now, it's not necessary to be completely worried at this stage because some mutations are good. In essence, evolution requires a certain frequency of mutation to arise to provide a driving force. If there was no mutations and no evolution, we'd still be around in the prebiotic soup. So you need a certain level of mutation for life to evolve. But the problem is that DNA damage and mutations occur randomly throughout the genome, which means that good genes and bad genes can be affected. And the probable or possible negative aspect of this fate is that you end up with a sort of Frankenstein scenario where you have a zombie-type cell that's now not receiving physiological signals from its neighboring cells. It's not listening to its physiological conditions, and it's not taking a note of what cells surrounding it are telling it in terms of whether it should grow or not. And this, of course, is a situation that can ultimately lead to oncogenesis and cancers. So there are potentially bad mutations that can turn a cell into this sort of zombie status. And these two types of cell fate, cell death, or the sort of Night of the Living Dead type scenario can arise in any cells in the body in response to DNA damage. DNA damage is a random process. It can hit any gene in any cell in any tissue. What that means is if you have enough of this damage arising, then DNA damage can effectively impact on multiple aspects of human health because it can arise in different kinds of tissue throughout the body. However, there are certain aspects of human pathology that reoccurringly tend to be implicated with unrepaired DNA damage. That's to say, if you have unrepaired DNA damage, there's certain types of pathology that are likely to be affected more than others. And the three major ones that reoccur in our field are aging. That's an impact of unrepaired damage on aging, or the rate of aging. Neurological dysfunction, so there's very clear links between DNA damage and neurological dysfunction, and of course cancer. And it's cancer that perhaps has the strongest connection to unrepaired damage. There are several types of study that have led to our understanding of the linkage between DNA damage and human disease. One type of study is epidemiological, where people actually study the frequency at which individuals encounter DNA damaging agents in the environment and correlate that with the onset or frequency of disease. But in actual fact, there are also more direct ways of demonstrating that unrepaired damage impacts on human health. And those direct methods revolve around the field of genetics. So out there in the human population, there are individuals walking around with rare genetic disorders in which their ability to deal with and repair damaged DNA has gone. And usually what we find in those individuals is a massively increased predisposition to either cancer frequencies, to neurological degeneration, or even to premature aging under some circumstances. And this is direct and unequivocal proof that if you don't repair your DNA damage, it's going to impact on human health. One very striking example of that is a disease that's worked on by Alan Lehman. Alan's sitting in the audience somewhere. Alan in the center works on this disease, xeroderma pigmentosum, which is a disorder in which the individuals lack the ability to repair DNA damage induced by ultraviolet light. And the consequence of that is that these individuals, if their exposure to UV is not controlled, they have 100% risk of developing skin cancers. Now, 20 or 30 years ago, this was a serious problem for patients with XP. This photo was taken in the 1970s, and you can see here the massive disfigurement that these individuals encountered through exposure to sunlight. Now, we're not talking about excessive exposure to UV light here. We're talking about, you know, a 5 to 10 minute stroll in a reasonably sunny day around the campus. And this is the kind of damage that exposure to that kind of UV light can induce. And these are a mixture of both pigmentation of the skin and the after effects of tumours. Now, the important feature here, which is why I actually chose this example, is that by understanding the nature of these genetic diseases, in this case, the fact that these diseases are unable to repair, cells from these individuals were unable to repair UV damage, by understanding that fact, we can inform clinical practice. We can actually inform these individuals to control their exposure to ultraviolet light. And nowadays, XP patients, as shown here, don't really ever encounter the sort of massive facial disfigurement that XP patients used to encounter before we understood the basis of that disease. So this brings home a very important point that underpins much of the work that we conduct in the Genome Center, that by understanding the nature of defects in DNA repair, we can reduce disease risk and we can also inform clinical practice. Okay, so again, DNA repair, DNA requires maintenance and repair. Now, any type of maintenance or repair job requires toolkits. That's the most important aspect of maintaining or repairing anything, as those avid DIYers amongst you will realize. Now, DNA has multiple types of damage. I sort of alluded to that at the beginning, and I've shown some various types here. This is a double strand break where both strands of the DNA have been broken. You can have bulky lesions, and this would fall into the class of UV photoproducts that I was showing you on the previous slide, and you can have single strand breaks. Now, because these types of damage look different to a cell, you need multiple different toolkits. So you need, for example, for a double strand break, you need a double strand break repair toolkit. For bulky lesions, you need a nucleotide excision repair toolkit. And for single strand breaks, you need a single strand break repair kit. And it's this latter one that's been the focus of research in my lab. So we're very interested in understanding how these structures, single strand breaks, are repaired, and identifying novel components of this human toolkit and how those components work together. And one of the reasons we're so interested in single strand breaks is that these are by far the most common type of DNA damage arising in cells. So of all those different types that I showed you in the second slide, these are the commonest component or the commonest contributor to those types of damage. So at least 1,000 per cell per hour. So even now during this lecture, each cell in your body that contains nuclear DNA will receive over 1,000 single strand breaks. So what I'm now going to do is open up that toolkit and explain to you or describe to you some of the common components and how they work together in human cells. So the first thing I need to do is explain a little bit more in detail about the chemistry of a single strand break. And there's only three things you need to note here. First, these two black lines are a cartoon of the DNA double helix. Okay. The second is that the break is in one strand, hence the name single strand break. And the third thing is that the termini of this break are, I've got these little red blobs on the end. Termini breaks come in two flavors. They're either 3' or 5'. Now, you don't need to worry about what that means, other than they have a defined polarity to them. And these blobs indicate that at those termini, there is chemical damage. So those termini are not of the right chemistry for repair to occur, and those red blobs need to be removed. And that's going to be a really important underlying theme of the rest of what I'll say tonight. Finally, at this break, typically there's missing genetic information here, hence the gap between the red blobs, and that genetic information must be replaced if repair and DNA stability is going to be maintained. So the first step in any sort of repair job is detection. So cells are no different. They have a damage detection system. In this case, they don't use binoculars. They have a kind of molecular equivalent. And they use a protein called PARP. And you don't need to worry about what this protein does. In essence, this molecule is scanning DNA looking for single strand breaks. When it finds them, it bends the DNA, quite a sharp angle, and so it's pointing the damage out into the sort of nuclear milieu. And that allows other components of the toolkit to come along and fix the damage that's present here at the apex of this bend. Now, the way PARP does this and facilitates the subsequent steps of repair is to generate a highly charged cloud in the vicinity of the break. And this highly charged cloud serves as a signal to the cell that there is damage present at this particular location in the chromosome and that you need to get your single strand break repair toolkit out. Now, The next step of the toolkit, or the reaction, is something called end processing. And I was trying to think of a sort of analogy, which would, a sort of non-scientific analogy of what end processing is. End processing relates to the presence of these red blobs I talked about. So, and the best one I could come up with was, if you imagine you've got a piece of cotton and you're trying to thread a needle with that cotton, if the cotton has a frayed edge, it's almost impossible to thread it through the eye of the needle, right? So what you immediately do is get up off your seat, walk into the kitchen, get your pair of scissors, snip off the frayed edge, and then you can thread your needle. And in essence, end processing is a very similar phenomenon at the sort of molecular level. So end processing serves to take these frayed edges and snip them off. So to snip them off, you need another tool from your toolkit, and the tool that's used here would be something akin to a sort of Swiss army knife. Now you need multiple blades because these little red blobs are not all of the same flavor. You get different kind of frayed edges at the ends of breaks, different kinds of chemical damage, and you need different kinds of blades to deal with a different type of damage. So in end processing, the Swiss Army knife actually comes along in cells as two components. The first component is an analogous structure to the handle of the Swiss Army knife, and that's provided by these two proteins here. And these serve as a scaffold in which, if you like, the blades become inserted. The important part of the blades, and of course we don't have blades in cells, but what we do have are enzymes that can very much mimic what a blade will do. And different blades essentially mean you have different enzymes that can cut different damaged structures. So it's the job of that Swiss Army knife to remove those red blobs and convert those termini to a chemistry that's appropriate for the final stages of repair. And that chemistry is a 3' hydroxyl and a 5' phosphate, for those of you who have a sort of an interest in chemistry. Now, remember I said there was missing genetic information at that break. That information is still missing, so now you need to fill that gap. So we have a gap-filling step, and if you're going to fill any gap, it's nice to have something to fill it with. So out of your toolbox, you pull these bricks and cement. Now, of course, we don't have bricks in cells. What we do have are enzymes that can catalyze the synthesis of new pieces of DNA. So in essence, this missing genetic information is replaced by a DNA polymerase that inserts missing nucleotides. And what you're left with now is the final step needed for repair. You now have a simple nick in one strand of the duplex. To seal that nick, you go back to your toolbox and you find some molecular glue. And this reaction now, this final reaction, is called DNA ligation. And the glue that will conduct that reaction is an enzyme called the DNA ligase. And that's quite fortuitous because DNA ligase 3, one of the known ligases in human cells, has been at the site of this break all the way through the reaction because it forms a very tight complex with this scaffold molecule XRCC1. So now ligase 3 can reseal that nick. Okay, so the work of my lab is primarily aimed at understanding this molecular network of reactions, identifying new components of the toolkit in human cells, and trying to understand how those components talk to each other and work together to repair this damage as fast as possible. And this is an extremely fast reaction. So typically, single-strand breaks can be repaired within seconds. It's a housekeeping process. It's occurring now while I'm speaking thousands of times in an hour to deal with the sort of constant assault that DNA is receiving. But what I want to spend the rest of the time talking about is a question of whether this pathway is protecting humans against human disease. So going back to the sort of experiments I talked about at the beginning, are there humans walking around in the population who have defects in this process and consequently have disease pathology? So that's the question that I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about. Are defects in single-strand break repair toolkit associated with human disease? Now, for a long time, I didn't think they would be. And I didn't think they would be because this pathway is so important and because the damage it repairs is so prevalent. But of course, if you go back to the analogy of a toolkit, different components of a toolkit have different importance under different situations. So you might go to your toolkit, and if the screwdriver is missing from it, you're in trouble. There's not a lot you can do. But if you go to the toolkit and the spirit level's missing, you may well be able to conduct most of the repair jobs you need to do. And it's kind of similar in human cells. It's possible that certain components of the enzymatic toolkit can be dispensed with or lost in humans without causing lethality, but still might generate some pathology. And it's those individuals that we would be interested in finding. Now, the first connection between this pathway and human disease actually emerged from experiments that we were conducting, not with human cells, but with something very much removed in evolutionary terms, which is budding yeast. Now, budding yeast is a very useful organism, and you will undoubtedly have encountered it in your sort of normal day-to-day lives. It's extremely good for producing beer, and it's extremely good for producing bread. But apart from brewing and baking, budding yeast is a very good scientist. There are a number of groups in the Genome Center who use budding yeast, and a number of groups who use a sort of related yeast called Schizosaccharomyces pombi or fission yeast. Yeast are very good for doing biology and are very good at informing us about underlying important processes of how DNA stability is maintained. So a number of years ago, we were using yeast as a tool, really, to try and identify new components of the human single strand break repair toolkit. And what we were looking for were proteins that interacted physically with XRCC1, which, if you remember, was the sort of formed the handle of this Swiss Army knife end processing tool. And we identified a number of genes during that process, during those experiments, some of which we knew already to be human components of single-strand break repair. So DNA ligase 3, I've talked about already, DNA polymerase beta, and DNA polynucleotide kinase. We sort of knew that these were important proteins in the repair process already. But we were struck by this new factor here, which we called XIP1 for XRCC1 interacting protein 1. And at the time, in the genome databases, this protein was an unclassified open reading frame, so it had no known function. It looked quite interesting when you actually looked at the structure of this molecule. It was very modular in design, so it had an amino terminus that was the route by which this protein bound XRCC1. So this was how this protein is recruited into the single-strand break repair toolbox. It had a domain that allowed this protein to be recruited into the nucleus, called a nuclear localization signal. That's a good thing, because most DNA damage is in the nucleus, so you need to get your toolkit into the nucleus. It had a hit domain, or histidine triad domain, that looked like it was going to turn out to be an active site. And this is the business end of an enzyme. It's the part of the molecule that actually conducts the enzymatic reaction of repairing DNA. And it had a zinc finger domain, which is very well classified in proteins as being DNA binding motif. So that's good. It's good that you've got, if you're going to have a DNA repair enzyme, it's good that it will bind DNA. But that's about as much as we knew on this protein for quite some time. And then one day, I was reading the recent literature in a journal called Nature Genetics. Scientists spend a lot of their time doing this, if they're lucky. And I noticed two papers back-to-back in the same journal that took my attention. They were both describing the same disease, although they were actually calling the disease different things. One was calling it ataxia ocular apraxia 1. The other was calling it early onset ataxia with ocular motor apraxia. Those are actually the same disease. And the reason they're called different things is because the group on the bottom were Japanese and the group on the top were European, and they wanted to claim the name for themselves, if you like. But what really struck my attention was the fact that both of these diseases were resulting from mutation in a new protein that had a hit domain and a zinc finger domain. And these were exactly the types of domains that we previously identified in our protein, XIP1. So I was wondering, I mean, hit domain proteins actually form a large family, and I was wondering whether or not our protein, XIP1, might be a member of that superfamily. So I sort of rushed off back to my office, got onto the computer, and pulled up the sequence for the two proteins. So this is all on the database. It's very easy to do. This was the apraxin protein that was mutated in those diseases, and this is XIP1, our sequence. And in fact, when I compared them, not only were they related, they turned out to be identical. So they were exactly the same gene. So XIP1 is apraxin. And so XIP1 and apraxin are the same gene, i.e., the same gene that's mutated in this disease. And so this was a kind of a real eureka moment for my lab, because it was the first time that we'd seen a direct physical connection between the repair pathway we were interested in and hereditary human disease. So at that point, I thought it was worth actually looking into this disease a bit further and trying to understand it. And this is a summary of the pathology behind this disease. It's a hereditary genetic disease, and like most of those diseases, it's relatively uncommon. But nevertheless, given the population of the world, we're still talking about 3 million affected individuals worldwide. It's an early onset disease, typically between 1 to 16 years of age. The pathology is restricted to the nervous system. This was a big, big shock to me, because we were under the misillusion, as it turns out, that if individuals were walking around with defects in single-strand break repair, they would have increased predisposition to cancers, because many diseases associated with defects in repair have increased cancer predisposition. And this had none, so this was really quite striking to us. Variable mental retardation, so the Japanese patients tend to have mental retardation. Patients from Europe typically don't have mental retardation. It's not clear why that difference arises, given it's the same gene. Patients tend to have oculomotor apraxia, and that's really where some of the name comes from. Oculomotor apraxia is an inability to control eye movement properly. So if I was to hold this pen out over here and track it across my vision, my eyes would follow it, and I would just move my eyes backwards and forwards. In patients who have oculomotor apraxia, they can't do that. Their eyes do not follow a stimulus, a command that's emerging from their central nervous system. So a patient who has this disease, when they want to follow something, they have to shift. So the object will move past them, their eyes won't follow, so they move their head. And if it goes back, they'll move their head back like that. So you'll see this sort of head movement as they try and focus on a particular object. And that's oculomotor apraxia. But the real physical pathology of this disease comes from the cerebellar degeneration. And I have an MRI scan of that. This is a normal individual MRI scan. This is an AOA1 patient. And the cerebellum is this structure here at the back of the brain. You can see it's quite healthy. It fills up most of the black area in the normal individual. But in the AOA1 patient, you can see it's heavily degenerated. This is a progressive phenomenon. So these individuals are not born with degenerated cerebellums, but the cerebellum degenerates as they age. It's a progressive neurodegenerative disease. And the consequence of that cerebellar degeneration is spinocerebellar ataxia. And this is the underlying characteristic feature of this disease and of the related disease that I'm going to talk about. And the reason cerebellar degeneration results in spinocerebellar ataxia is because it's the cerebellum that controls balance and movement. It's the cerebellum that allows me to walk across the floor in a straight line without staggering or falling over. And in individuals with degenerated cerebellum, they have problems of coordination and balance. So ataxia actually is a Greek word, means lack of order. And so this is a disease of coordination of balance. And I'll show you an example of gait ataxia in a minute. We have a little movie of that. It's a serious problem. So ataxia has multiple genetic causes. This disease of apraxin, or mutations of apraxin, are not the only cause of ataxia. In fact, they only comprise a small component of ataxic patients. It affects 10,000 adults in the UK, and it's serious enough to have its own charity in the UK. So Ataxia UK is dedicated to helping out the families of children with ataxia, and they also support research into ataxia, although we don't actually have any funding from them at this stage. So I have a little movie of gait ataxia to sort of orientate you as to what this disease actually means in terms of balance. So this chap is not an AOA1 patient. He's actually a patient with a different related disease that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, but it's the only video we have. So he's visiting the clinician. The clinician is asking him to walk in a straight line, and you can see he has difficulty doing that. He tries, because he's got poor balance, he tries to accommodate that by, firstly, you can see his feet are quite spread out, and also his arms tend to come out to try and balance himself. But it doesn't really work, and so he has this sort of staggering gait. That's actually a relatively mild presentation of this disease, and the pathology is progressive. Clumsiness in AOA1, at least, the disease AOA1, the disease I'm talking about currently, the first presentation tends to be what's interpreted by the parents as clumsiness in the toddlers, but that leads to staggering or falling as the children grow older, and ultimately can result in them being wheelchair bound by age 10 or 11. So it's a fairly serious condition if you have children born with this disorder. So how does this protein, XIP1, as we called it, apraxin, as the disease literature call it, and from now on I'll just be referring to the name apraxin because that's the accepted term now. How does this protein protect against ataxia under normal circumstances? Well, it was quite clear that when you took this molecule and plotted onto that molecule the different mutations in that protein that are present in different individuals throughout the world, that all the mutations causing this disease focus on this hit domain. Remember, I told you this hit domain was the business end of the molecule. It's the bit that allows the enzyme to conduct its enzymatic activity. It contains the active site. So this tells you immediately that this domain is critical for preventing ataxia. Now, the nature of that domain, if you look at it in detail, sort of hints to you, for reasons I'm not going to go into, that this is probably a component of the Swiss Army knife. And it's involved in processing reactions at 5' termini. If you remember at the start, I said at single-strand breaks, there were two types of termini, 3' and 5', and that just referred to different polarity. Well, the polarity is quite important in terms of the way the terminus is repaired, and this protein looked like it might be one of the blades in a Swiss Army knife dealing with 5' termini. So I have to give you a little bit more of chemistry now, so I apologize for that, but it's not too difficult, I don't think. So this would be a typical 5' terminus that's in a healthy state and ready to be repaired. So the DNA molecule stretches to the right off the screen, and this is the final nucleotide sitting at the very end of the 5' end of the single-strand break. And a healthy terminus, so a non-frayed terminus, if you like, would have this phosphate moiety. And that's good. That allows the subsequent repair events to occur of filling in that missing information and finally gluing the break together. But in actual fact, most single-strand breaks that arise don't start off with healthy termini. They have those frayed termini. And in terms of chemistry, there are a variety of different frayings you can have. So you can actually have a hydroxyl group here instead of a phosphate. You can have an aldehydic group here. And you can even have a phosphate, which is normal, but you're missing the coding information, the base, this base site here. This is the bit of it that provides the coding information in DNA. So all different kinds of 5' termini, all requiring different enzymes to repair them. But epitaxin turned out not to repair any of those structures. Epitaxin turns out to repair what manifested as a completely novel type of 5' terminus. And that's a terminus with an AMP molecule stuck on the 5' end. Now, you don't need to worry about what AMP is or how AMP gets there. That's an entirely different story. But suffice it to say, we think this arises in cells, and that it's apotaxin's job to chop that AMP off the 5' end, restoring the terminus to a nice, healthy 5' phosphate. And it's quite amazing to think, really, that a simple enzymatic step, such as chopping off a small molecule such as AMP, is so important in preventing neuronal degeneration and leading to ataxia and disease. Okay, so now we can fit apotaxin into our toolkit. It works at this M processing step. It's one of the blades of this Swiss Army knife. So it sits there, it binds XRCC1, that's how it's recruited into the toolkit, and it specifically processes these 5' termini with AMP, restoring them back to phosphate. And that's what this molecule is probably doing most of the time. So that's one direct linkage now between this repair process and human genetic disease. And so, clearly, once this, this was very exciting. I mean, it was very exciting because, as I say, it was the first time this process had been linked to a human genetic disorder. And now the hunt was really on for other linkages between this process and human disease. And it didn't really take long before the next one emerged. So about a year later, another paper in Nature Genetics emerged. And this time it was describing mutation of a repair enzyme called TDP1. That was associated with a neurological disease called spinocerebellar ataxia with axonal neuropathy. The names of these diseases are absolutely horrendous, which is why we tend to shorten them to AOA1. And this one is shortened to SCAN1 for simplicity. What really struck me about this disease was the fact that it was a repair enzyme, and we knew this was a repair enzyme, so we had some understanding about this one, which was different from the situation we had with apotaxin. But the key thing was the fact the disease was associated with spinocerebellar ataxia, exactly the same kind of pathology that was associated with AOA1. So that really struck some chords. And in fact, when you compared the pathology of this disease, you'd be mistaken for thinking this was almost the same slide I showed you earlier. So there is cerebellar decay or cerebellar degeneration in the patients. You can see here the shriveled cerebellum compared to the normal one. Pathology, again, is restricted to the nervous system, no predisposition to cancer. Variable onset, typically a little bit later than AOA1s, about 15 years. Very pronounced progressive cerebellar degeneration, and importantly, spinocerebellar ataxia. In actual fact, that movie I showed you of gait ataxia was a patient with scan 1. So how does TDP-1 protect against ataxia? Well, like apraxin, TDP-1 is a protein that's modular in structure, has this interesting yellow domain called the NTD, which stands for N-terminal domain, and it has the bulk of it is comprised of this blue domain. PDD stands for phosphodiesterase domain. You don't need to understand that. Essentially, once again, this is the active site of this molecule. The mutations that are present in this protein in SCAM1 again locate to the active site, telling you that this domain, whatever it does, is very important normally in humans in preventing neurological decline. Well, we're in a better situation with TDP-1 because there had been quite a lot of prior literature on how TDP-1 works as an enzyme. A lot of work actually in budding yeast again. So we had a little bit more understanding about this molecule. And we already knew from the literature that this was an M-processing tool. So this again was another one of these blades in the Swiss Army knife. The difference being that unlike apraxin, which works on 5' termini, this protein works on the other terminus at the break, 3' termini. Bit more chemistry. There are multiple types of 3' termina, multiple types of fraying, if you like. So the proper type of 3' terminus would be a hydroxyl. So now the DNA is extending this way to the left and off the screen. And this would be the normal chemistry for a terminus. It's ready to be fully repaired, a hydroxyl. But usually breaks don't have a hydroxyl. They have a phosphate, which really should be on the 5' end. It's on the wrong end, so that's bad. You can have a phosphoglycolate, which is a fragmented sugar. You can have an aldehyde group on the 3' end, or you can even have bits of protein stuck on the 3' end. Now, I'm not going to go into how these structures arise. Suffice it to say, they're not very nice for a cell if they're trying to repair the breaks. Now, it turns out that TDP-1 likes to repair these structures. It likes to cut off these bits of protein from the 3' end, and it also likes to cut off, to a lesser extent, these fragmented sugars called phosphoglycolates. Now, that all sounds very good, and you would immediately think now that we've identified a second link between single-strand break repair and genetic disease. But there was a real stumbling block with that hypothesis. And the stumbling block came when we looked at the literature on what was understood about TDP-1 activity. And as I say, most of the work on the role of TDP-1 in living cells had been conducted on budding yeast. And in budding yeast, it was clear that TDP-1 processed the type of terminus that I just showed you, but it processed it on this kind of DNA structure. Now, this is a very situation that arises when the DNA duplex is being replicated in a proliferating cell. And what you now have is a double-strand break present at what we call a collapsed replication fork. And again, I'm not going to go into the details of how this arises. The important concept here is that this protein, TDP-1, is working at a double-strand break at a collapsed replication fork. There's a big problem here if we're going to argue that this is the process that's defective in SCAM1. Because SCAM1 is a disease exclusively of postmitotic neurons in the nervous system. So those neurons are not replicating. So this structure should not be arising and cannot arise under those situations. So how can we argue then that loss of TDP-1 is causing that neurological degeneration when the structure TDP-1 is supposed to process is not actually present? It doesn't make sense. So we reasoned that maybe, in fact, in human cells, TDP-1 does something different. Yes, it processes this type of structure, but actually, maybe it also processes our favorite type of damage, a single-strand break. So this is a hypothesis. Now, if we're going to make a hypothesis like this, you would think there should be something about these two proteins that encourages you that the human protein can do something different from the yeast protein. And indeed, that looks like it might be the case. If you align these two proteins, and I've shown you the human one already, if you align the human protein with the yeast protein, the first astounding thing you notice is that even though you go all the way down the evolutionary ladder to budding yeast, a single cellular organism, the molecules, the active site of this enzyme, looks almost identical. has the same catalytic functions, has the same conformation at the active site, the part of the molecule that helps repair DNA. However, yeast TDP1 is missing this yellow box, so it's missing this extended amino terminus. Now, this is a sort. This is, provides a real clue, because in human proteins, very often a catalytic activity is targeted to a specific enzymatic reaction by interacting with other protein components of that reaction. And those protein interactions are usually mediated, or often mediated, by what we call extended amino terminal or extended C-terminal domains. So in essence, what you have is an active site, but you can have an extra bit of protein on the left end or the right end, and it's that extra bit that targets the active site or the enzyme to a particular process. So we predicted or speculated that maybe this extended terminus that's present in the human protein but not the yeast might be the way that this protein, TDP1, gets coupled into or placed into the single-strand break repair toolbox. And we had another mini eureka moment, because we systematically looked at the ability of this human protein to interact with all the known components, or many of the known components of single-strand break repair, and we struck lucky with one of those molecules, DNA ligase 3, the sort of the molecular glue of the single-strand break repair process, turns out to be the binding site of TDP1. So that was very nice. So TDP1 interacts with the single-strand break repair machinery. The key question was, is TDP1 required for single-strand break repair? So yes, TDP1's in the single-strand break repair toolbox, but is it actually needed in that toolbox? So to answer that question, we contacted this chap, James Lupski, who works in the United States Baylor College of Medicine, and it was Jim who'd actually identified TDP1 mutations in SCAM1 patients. And Jim was the only person who actually had material from the patients. And we contacted Jim, and Jim said, we asked him for some material from the patients so we could look at the repair capacity of those individuals, and he very kindly sent us some cultured blood cells from those individuals. And we asked a very simple question. We took the blood cells either from the wild-type individuals or from the patients, and we had three patients, and we asked the question, what is the level of single-strand breakage in those individuals under different environmental conditions? And you don't need to worry about what this scale is, except that the bigger the number, the more single-strand breaks. We looked at four conditions. First, we looked at the number of single-strand breaks in the untreated blood cells, that is, blood cells that we've not treated with any agent that would normally introduce DNA damage. And when we did that, we didn't see a difference. Well, that's okay, because the types of assays we use are usually not sensitive enough to pick up small differences in single-strand breakage. We also asked the question, if we now treated these cells with an oxidizing agent, H2O2, what level of strand breaks now are present in those cells? Now, H2O2 is a physiologically relevant source of oxidated DNA damage. It's one of the ways that single-strand breaks actually arise in cells normally. So that was a useful agent to use. When we did that, we saw a massive increase in single-strand breaks. The level of breaks was similar in all of the different blood cells from the patients or normal individuals. And then we asked the question, what happened now if we took peroxide away from these cells? How quickly would those single-strand breaks repair? Could we see a difference between the normal patients and the normal individuals and the patients? Well, the repair rate in the normal individual is extremely fast. So the gray bars are the number of breaks remaining after 30 minutes of repair, and the lighter gray ones are the breaks remaining after 60 minutes of repair. So you can see this is a very fast process, and we knew it would be because we have a lot of experience and we know how quickly this pathway works in a normal cell. So you can see the breaks are almost gone within an hour. However, when we looked at the patients, it was a very different situation. And there was clearly retarded repair in all three of the blood cells taken from the patients. So quite clearly then, TDP1 is required for single-strand break repair, and defects in this process are observed in SCAM1. So I've only got two slides, I think, now, and I'm going to wind up because of the time. So this is our toolkit. We had AOA1, one of the diseases linked to this process through mutations in apotaxin, which turned out now to be a novel component of this Swiss Army knife. We can add TDP1 to this scheme now. TDP1 also is a component of this Swiss Army knife, so it forms another one of the blades. TDP1 is sequestered into the toolkit through interaction with ligase 3, whereas apotaxin is sequestered into the toolkit through interaction with XRCC1. Now, GDP1 processes the 3' terminus, whereas epitaxin processes the 5' terminus. So this is quite nice. You can see now with all these different blades, you can actually process both termini at the break. What it does is remove any obstructions on the 3' end and restores a nice hydroxyl, and this is the chemistry that the cell likes to see to complete these subsequent steps. So we now have two connections between single-strand break repair and human disease, and this is pretty much the stage we're at now in terms of understanding the relationship of this process with human disease. And we're very keen now to understand, continue to understand, why it is that these breaks result in neurological disease. And of course, we're also interested in understanding whether any of these other components of the toolkit are, if they're mutated, if they're represented by humans, human disease. So if there are other people walking out there with mutations in XLCC1, for example. So there are many big questions we're trying to address, and this is where I'm going to leave it. So is single-strand break repair really neuroprotective? This is a subtle question in many ways. What we've shown is an association. Currently, with the experiments we've done, we've shown an association between a genetic disease and the absence of a repair process. That's not direct proof that the absence of that repair process causes the disease. You need more refined experiments to prove that, and we're using a mouse model system to address that. Some really big questions remain, though. Why is the brain selectively affected? There are lots of post-mitotic cells in your body. Most of your cells, in fact, are not cycling. Why is it only neurons are affected or selectively affected? Why specifically the cerebellum? Most of the brain is made up of non-cycling cells, so why is the cerebellum so sensitive to loss of these proteins? What about normal aging? So there is a lot of data in the literature suggesting that oxidative stress and oxidative DNA damage may be a factor in the rate at which we age, the rate at which normal individuals age, not just repair defective individuals. So what contribution do unrepaired single-strand breaks make to that, if any? And why is there no cancer predisposition in these diseases? This is a really interesting question, because we would have predicted to begin with that loss of single-strand break repair would result in increased cancer due to the fact that DNA becomes unstable. It's clearly not the case. So those are the questions we are hoping to address in the next foreseeable future, at least. I'm going to skip this because I'm overrunning and go straight to the credit slide. So this is my lab, so I have to thank my lab for all of the work I've talked about. It was not done by me, it was done by my lab. This is quite an old one now, but I think it includes most of the people who have done the work. And particular thanks go to this chap, Sharif, who's in the audience, who's the person who really pushed forward a lot of the work on the SCAM1 disease. And it's hard to pick them out from this angle, but this is sort of a general contribution from the group to the work I've talked about. And without them, it would never have occurred. Similarly, the funding agencies, without which we could never do the sorts of experiments that I've been discussing. And we're supported by the government through the Medical Research Council and the BBSRC for European funding, and also Cancer Research UK, a cancer charity as well. And at that point, I think I will leave it and take questions if there are any.